Turning now to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 31, and the first verse of the chapter, Deuteronomy, chapter 31, and Moses went and spake these words unto all Israel. This will be, aside from the song of Moses, his last address, 3,500 years ago, given on his 120th birthday, as he says at the very outset of his address. And this is about great prophecies of Moses in the last chapters of Deuteronomy. And I'd like to read to you verse 2. He said unto them, I am 120 years old this day. I can no more go out and come in. Also the Lord hath said unto me, thou shalt not go over this Jordan. It's the last address before he formally hands over to Joshua to lead the people into the promised land. He cannot go out and come in, which is a kind of figure of speech in the Hebrew, in the times, which means he cannot do his normal work. Certainly does not mean he's housebound. He's going to be described shortly as being in extremely good health at 120 years of age. But it means he's no longer up to the arduous role that he's taken on in leading the people, leading them on their journeys, and leading them into the promised land. But that's not the reason why he won't lead them. God has prevented him, or will prevent him, from leading the people into the promised land, and we'll come to that as we go through these passages. These are remarkable closing chapters. Really, well, we must get on, because if we're going to complete the book in a single evening, we've a lot to do, and I shall proceed in the manner of a kind of Bible reading. It's really the most straightforward way of throwing light on these tremendous verses. So I go down, first of all, to verse 4. The Lord shall do unto them, when you go into the land of promise, as he did to Zion and to Og, kings of the Amorites, and unto the land of them whom he destroyed. And so the people of God are given those past victories as tokens of what is coming in the future. They are to look back. In order to muster the courage and the faith to go forward. And we won't stay with that, but that's a great principle for us. We remind ourselves frequently of the great answers to prayer and the great deliverances and the great things that God has done, because we need to do that to strengthen our determination and faith for the future. And then the exhortation in verse 6 of chapter 31, be strong and of a good courage, fear not nor be afraid of them. And I wouldn't like you to think that this is just repetition. There are great tests ahead for them, as there are tests for us. And each of these exhortations has really an independent sense. Be strong, be determined to serve the Lord and to be a profitable servant. And of a good courage. Well, the meaning is obvious. There will be dangers. Besides determination, you've got to resolve that when dangers come, you won't be afraid of them and recoil. They're really two separate points. Fear not. Well, that indicates don't lose your faith. Always remember that in the Christian life, just as they had to remember in the battles ahead, we're commissioned to obey the Lord and to represent him and to serve him. And so we're not to allow faith to fail and be afraid of the task or our spiritual enemies. And then the next term, nor be afraid of them, isn't repetition. It literally means don't stand in awe of them or in dread. And it's a same theme, but a separate thought. You've got to maintain your faith and your courage. But if you look at the enemy and you consider too much their numbers and their strength, their fierceness and their capability of cruelty, well, then you'll stand in awe of them and of dread, and you'll undermine yourself. So, same theme, yes, but each term is different. And then, for he it is, for the Lord thy God, last part of verse 6, he it is that doth go with thee. Consider him, and consider his might and his majesty, and his integrity, and his promises, and he cannot fail to keep them. He will not fail thee, nor forsake thee. And every clause in that verse, every term, is really separate from the preceding one, and worthy of thought and consideration, in order that we should encourage our hearts. And then, verse 7, Moses called unto Joshua, and said unto him in the sight of all Israel, be strong. The leader, too, must be individually exhorted. And as all leaders, office bearers, fathers in families, they have a prime commission to stand and to show courage and to lead in whatever happens, and to remember to look to God. Verse 8, and the Lord, he it is, no one less. It's the Lord who goes before you. Remember that. It's God himself. He will be with thee. He will not fail thee, neither forsake thee. His honour and his name's at stake. He cannot break his promises to his people. He will undertake for us. So fear not, neither be dismayed. And the earlier exhortation is repeated. Then come down to verse 9. And Moses wrote this law, and you must appreciate that this now is speaking of the entire Pentateuch, not just the Ten Commandments, not just the subsidiary laws to the Ten Commandments and the explanations, but it refers to all the writings of Moses, including this book, Deuteronomy, the last messages of Moses. Moses wrote this law and the whole Pentateuch and delivered it unto the priests, the sons of Levi, which bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord, and unto all the elders of Israel. So they have this much of the scripture. They have the five books of Moses, the Pentateuch. And verse 10, Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, in the solemnity of the year of release, when all the slaves and so on are released and all the debts are released, in the Feast of Tabernacles, when all Israel is come to appear before the Lord thy God, in the place which he shall choose, thou shalt read this law before all Israel in their hearing. That's so vital and so important. The law must always be in view. And so it is in New Testament times. We're saved by grace, and we trust in the atoning death of Christ. And law-keeping cannot save us, but once saved, it's the rule, the moral law for our lives. And there in verse 12, all the people must be gathered. And verse 13, particularly the children, and these things must be read. And in verse 14 of chapter 31, the Lord speaks directly to Moses and reminds him that he is to die and that Joshua must be formally installed. And he commands them to go to the tabernacle of the congregation. And they did so. And the Lord appeared as of old in a pillar of a cloud, and it stood over the door of the tabernacle. And then Joshua is formally to be commissioned. But then in verse 16, the Lord said unto Moses, you will sleep with your fathers, and this people will rise up and go a-whoring after the gods of the strangers of the land. Idolatry is going to take hold of the people. And Moses repeatedly is warned of this, and he's to warn the people that Israel will not be faithful. They'll have great blessings and they'll turn to the gods around them. And the same thing happens in churches frequently today. The gods around us, not now the silver and gold and wooden overlaid gods of pagan people, but the gods around us are worldliness. worldly things and possessions and for their own sake and acquisitiveness and worldly entertainments. These are the alternatives to God in the world. These are the things that are worshipped and adored that people seek after for satisfaction. Whenever you read idols in the Old Testament, as far as we're concerned in the West, in the East there are still many idols and idol worship. And certain other places, but in the West, whenever you read idols, read worldliness. That's the modern idolatry, turning to the things that the world selects as alternatives to God. And it's so offensive to him. And the Israelites would be guilty of turning to the idols of the nations around repeatedly. And they would repeatedly be punished by God and discarded by him. And a remnant only would be saved and brought out and the blessings renewed toward them. And then another generation would fall. And it's the constantly repeated strain of the Old Testament, the failure of the people. And Moses introduces it here, and it happens too in churches. You find, as you look at church history, there'll be awakening or revival or reformation, and many people saved, and many churches come into being, and they're loyal to the truth, and then many of them, happily not all, many of them leave the faith, leave the old ways, leave the doctrines that saved and established their fathers or their forebears, and those denominations go downhill and become discarded by God and no longer in communion with him, with the Spirit of God working in them and through them. And nowadays we can observe the process in midstream. People who once had a clear stand now going over to worldliness en masse, and they'll lose their lampstand, those churches. Of course, God is very gracious and he exercises immense patience, and it often takes years before he discards us when we deserve to be discarded as churches, and constantly appeals and calls. But in the course of time, the lampstand is removed and down goes that church or group of churches, and the warning begins to be sounded even in the earliest books of the Bible and in the sermons of Moses. Well, just look down to verse 24 of this chapter, and a song is going to be introduced. But in verse 24 you read this: "It came to pass, when Moses had made an end of writing the words of this law," again it refers to the entire Pentateuch, "until they were finished, that Moses commanded the Levites, which bear the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, saying, take this book of the law and put it in the side of the Ark of the covenant of the Lord your God." Only the Ten Commandments went into the ark. We learn that in Exodus chapter 25. So the rest of the Pentateuch is put alongside the Ark of the Covenant. And then the words at the end of verse 26, "that it may be there for a witness against thee." What ominous words. The law, which should be their delight and their comfort and sustain the whole nation and be a blessing and keep them in fellowship with God, will sadly, for most of the Israelites, be a witness against them, because they will forsake it. That's the tragedy of Israel of old. Now I go down to chapter 32, the song of Moses. It's a very sad song, mostly, because it's all about this whole problem of backsliding and then turning aside. The beginning of it and the end of it are in an entirely different note. "Give ear, O ye heavens, and I will speak, and hear, O earth, the words of my mouth." Introduction to the song. Verse 2, "My doctrine shall drop as the rain." This will be refreshing doctrine. "My speech shall distill as the dew." It'll be life imparting. "As the small rain upon the tender herb." It'll stimulate growth and as showers upon the grass. The doctrine of the Word of God, oh, it's life-giving and refreshing. In fact, it's about salvation. We went through chapters 29 and chapter 30, last study, and we noted this was all about grace. Grace, the way of salvation, not works. The great offers of God to the human race and to individuals. And that's what the doctrine amounts to. That's what Moses taught alongside the law. The law to humble us, and yet grace offered to secure forgiveness and life. But that's not how it's going to turn out for so many of the Israelites. Look at verse 4, the great attributes of God. He is the rock, or at the end of verse 3, because I will publish the name of the Lord. Ascribe ye greatness unto our God. He is the rock. His work is perfect, for all his ways are judgment. A God of truth and without iniquity, just and right is he. Some of the great attributes of Almighty God. Then it turns to the Israelites. And this hasn't happened yet, but it's in their hearts. Verse 5, they have corrupted themselves. Their spot, or their defilement, is not the spot of his children. It is not a character of true children of God. They are a perverse and crooked generation. Do ye thus requite the Lord? Do you pay him back in this way? Verse 6, O foolish people and unwise, is not he thy father that hath bought thee, redeemed you out of Egypt? Hath he not made thee and established thee as a nation as well as individuals? And this is how you pay me back, or will do so, by idolatry. And then look at verse 7. Remember the days of old, all the things I did for you, and what I showed you. Doesn't it mean anything? And here is appeal and reasoning. And there is a rehearsal of the past in chapter 32 and this 8th verse. Some beautiful verses. Look at verse 9. For the Lord's portion is his people. I have treated you, God seems to say, as though you were my inheritance, the most precious thing in my view. Verse 10, he found him in a desert land, and in the waste, howling wilderness. He led him about, instructed him, he kept him as the apple of his eye. The apple of the eye is the pupil of the eye. It's a figure of speech, and it means that God dealt with us as though we were the only thing in his view. Of course we were not, but as though he loved us in such a way and dealt with us, to the Jews that is of old, as with his people today, as though we were the only things he had his mind on. And verse 11, as an eagle stirreth up her nest, fluttereth over her young, spreadeth abroad her wings. And God describes himself like that great parent bird taking care of the eggs and of the young. So closely has he attended to their needs. And this is how you treated me, he seems to say. Verse 12, so the Lord alone did lead him, and there was no strange God with him. And he made him ride on the high places of the earth with tremendous blessings and light and understanding and status, and gave increase to the fields and so on. All the benefits that had been to the people. And verse 15, but Jeshurun, which means the righteous one, which is a name for Israel, it certainly was not righteous, in fact, but that's the name God gives to Israel quite frequently. Jeshurun waxed fat and kicked, and in wealth and plenty that was given to him, he forsook God which made him and lightly esteemed the rock of his salvation. Verse 16, turned to strange gods, in our case to worldliness perhaps. With abominations provoked they him to anger. They sacrificed unto devils, same theme. People, even people who are supposed to be Christians, give so much time and adulation to things that are demonic and worldly, not to God. Verse 17, to gods whom they knew not. You couldn't have a living relationship with those gods. You won't have any living relationship with the things of this world. They won't bless you and grow your character and reveal themselves to you. Verse 18, of the rock that begat thee, Moses says to the Israelites, thou art unmindful, you don't think of him, and hast forgotten the God that formed thee. And this, well, horrific 19th verse, and when the Lord saw it, he abhorred them. Literally, he despised them. To be despised by God. Why? Because of their foolishness and their provocative behavior. And so the statement of the song goes on. All these verses would be learned by heart by the children of Israel. That was the idea of their being assembled into a song. They'd be learned by heart and sung or chanted, however they did it, in their kind of liturgy in those days. So they all knew them. This hadn't happened yet. Don't you see? As they shelved into and pitched into apostasy and rejection of God, they actually had the prophecy of it in their heads, learned by heart. And it still didn't stop them. This is a lesson for us. No wonder God saves by grace alone. Because here in the Old Testament, there are people who he selects, he does wonders for them, he leads them, he guides them, he does so much for them, even teaches them a song about their demise, their fall, and none of it stops them pitching down. The rebelliousness, the depravity of the human heart. If someone were to say to you, I don't believe what you tell me as you speak to me about Christ and the atonement, and nobody can come to God except by grace, except by Christ dying for them. No one can earn salvation. No one is as bad as that. Well, the whole Old Testament history of God going out of his way to be so kind to a nation for so many centuries and yet be rejected by them is a lesson in the truth of this. There's no hope of salvation unless a Saviour comes and dies for us and then transforms our hearts and changes us. And this all proves it. That's why it's done. God is kind to them, bears with them, and yet generation after generation, apart from a remnant saved by grace each time, reject him. And so that's the theme and the point of this song. And I've just led you through God's arguments, demonstrating how kind he had been to them. There's a very significant comment in verse 21 as Moses in the song speaks from God. They have moved me to jealousy with that which is not God. Now the sense of this is this. It is as though, not that God is able to be jealous, but he presents himself as though he is a husband or a wife who's been betrayed, and the spouse has been unfaithful. And God says, I am the one who's been betrayed, and you put me in the position of having to feel jealous over somebody who is completely worthless. You haven't even gone after somebody who's very beautiful or very handsome or very virtuous. You've picked the most useless, worthless, non-person imaginable, and you expect me to be jealous of that person. And this is the language God adopts. You've forsaken me for these nothing gods that cannot help you. And you, the ultimate insult God seems to say you can pay to me is to put me in the position, if I were a human being like you, of having to be jealous of that. Look what I've been forsaken for. That's a most unusual argument in the Old Testament, and yet that's how God seeks to put across to them the height of their insulting behaviour. And then chapter 32 and verse 32, "For their vine is of the vine of Sodom and of the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of gall, and their clusters are bitter. Their wine is the poison of dragons and the cruel venom of asps." And the point of this is that God is saying to them, the things you have chosen as alternatives to the worship of me are all things that can only hurt you. And that's very significant. And if I can update that, it's the same today. If you or I, as Christian believers, slide after worldly things and seek satisfaction from possessions or worldly pleasures or entertainments, those things will only hurt us. Somebody wants to get hooked on the rhythm drug. That can only hurt you, undermining your intelligence, your sensitivities, bringing you into captivity to something that's really quite base and fundamental and sensual. It can only hurt you and bring you then into admiring, in time, the whole ideology behind that kind of entertainment. It'll hurt you. It can't develop your character or assist you or deepen you. And that's the argument God uses to the Israelites of old. In going after those alternative gods, apart from the offence to God, you're only hurting yourself. You're drinking the poison of asps. It's all very damaging. So there's every kind of argument used in this song, which is designed to restrain them, but they would not be restrained, and to be a judgment against them. But when you come towards the end of it, then look at some of the verses. I take you down to verse 43. Rejoice, this is the end of the song, the very end of it. Rejoice, O ye nations, with his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants and will render vengeance to his adversaries and will be merciful unto his land and to his people. Now that's remarkable. What's that about? After all the warnings and the verses I did not go through, which speak of the terrible judgments which will come upon them, the final verse of the song doesn't seem to fit the song. It seems to change direction so suddenly. It's all slaying and punishment, and suddenly, rejoice, O ye nations, with his people. But after all, it isn't difficult to understand or to interpret, not least because it's quoted this verse by the Apostle Paul in Romans 15 and verse 10. And he explains to us that it's a prophecy about the calling of the Gentiles, among other things. The very end of the condemnation of Israelites says, well, rejoice, ye Gentiles, in effect. Rejoice, O ye nations, with his people. Who are they? Well, they're the faithful among the unfaithful Israelites. They're the minority that never went with the masses. Rejoice, Gentiles, with the faithful Israelites, for God will avenge the blood of his servants and render vengeance to his adversaries. And there will be a coming blessing. It's about the coming of Christ and the call of the Gentiles. The Epistle to the Hebrews tells us this, as well as Romans 15, verse 10. And so it's a remarkable tailpiece to what we may call the dismal song of Moses, warning about the demise of the Jews, at least the majority of them. So Verse 48 and 49, and then we'll go on to the grand final part. The Lord spake unto Moses that selfsame day, saying, and then he sent Moses up to a hilltop in order to view the promised land. He would view it, he would not go into it. Now turn to chapter 33, and time permitting, I'm going to briskly show you something I hope you'll find quite spectacular. Chapter 33, verse 1. And this is the blessing wherewith Moses, the man of God, blessed the children of Israel before his death. Now, right after the song comes the blessing. And we're shocked. But Moses, you've just said everything's going to go downhill. And so many of the Israelites will rebel and be lost. And there'll be a terrible extreme of apostasy and judgment to follow. And that was the history of Israel, so tragically. And then you solemnly bless all the tribes of Israel. And under each blessing, you say something wonderful is going to happen to that tribe and to that tribe. Is this the same Moses? Is this the same portion of Scripture? Well, the only way to understand it is to see this, that the blessing of the tribes of Israel is the pronouncement of Moses, its prophecy, about the true Israel, the true Zion, those who love the Lord, those who are the spiritual seed of Abraham. They have faith like faithful Abraham. These blessings given under each tribe are the blessings of all of them, and most conspicuously when Christ comes and the New Testament church of converted Jews and Gentiles is brought out together. It's Zion that is being blessed. The children of Israel by faith, much more than the children of Israel after the flesh, who've just been condemned in the previous chapter in the Song of Moses. And their sorry fall has been described in lurid detail. So this prophecy is about the faithful. Now, it is true that the prophecy will be fulfilled literally to the typical church, because from time to time, as you know, Israel will go down, be defeated, at times even taken into captivity en masse, and then they'll be delivered, at least a remnant of them will, and brought out and re-established, and so on. So in the typical church, which is disobedient Israel, God will fulfill these prophecies in a kind of symbolic way. But they cannot be truly fulfilled except in the Christian church. So let me very quickly take you through, and this is why I say this is a remarkable passage, no fewer than 17 promises. There are 17 distinctive, powerful promises made in this chapter for the Church of Jesus Christ, or the faithful Israelites, the faithful minority in olden times. And they start, strictly speaking, in verse 6 of chapter 33, starting with Reuben, the tribe of Reuben. Let Reuben live and not die, and let not his men be few. Now, it isn't just Reuben. These are promises to all the true Israel, the true Zion, and the New Testament church. And in there, in that short promise statement, you have two promises, the promise of life and the promise of numbers. And that applies to us. Two promises to the redeemed of Christ and to the faithful in all generations, that God will give his true people life, spiritual life. and that he'll also give them numbers. Many, many converts, many, many true believers. Now, we live in an age when we seem to have a day of small things in this country. There are not vast numbers, a huge percentage of the population that loves the Lord. But viewed worldwide, Christians are far more numerous than anyone can possibly imagine. And even in this country, probably more numerous than we realise. We'll always have numbers. Christian people, well, it is the empire of Jesus Christ is the only true world empire. Christ has people in every land and nation, and the number is tremendous. There'll always be numbers of Christians. Other empires die out, not this one. Right to the end of time, the number of people in heaven, when the roll is made up, it's a tremendous number indeed. I take you to verse 7. This is the blessing of Judah. And he said, "Hear, Lord, the voice of Judah, the promise of answered prayer." We've had life, we'd have numbers, now we've got answered prayer. "And bring him unto his people, let his hand be sufficient for him, and be thou an help to him from his enemies." So prayers are heard, and there in that verse, surely you saw it, is a veiled promise of Messiah. To us is the Messiah, the voice of Judah. Bring him unto his people. Let his hand be sufficient for him, and be thou an help to him from his enemies. And then in verse 8, and of Levi, he said, "Let thy Thummim and thy Urim be with thy Holy One." The Levites represent light and understanding. They are the great teachers of the ancient church. And that runs down for several verses, all the way down to verse 11. The dedication of Levi, but this isn't a promise of God, it's their duty to him, is brought out here. "Who said unto his father and to his mother, I have not seen him, neither did he acknowledge his brethren, nor knew his own children." These are events, historic events that are referred to, but what they amount to is this: Levi will be single-minded and altogether for the service of the Lord. Of course, the Levites of Israel were seldom so, but the people of God, priesthood of all believers, will have access to light and understanding. Verse 10, "They shall teach Jacob thy judgments and Israel thy law," will have light and instruction. So I go to verse 12. "And of Benjamin he said, the beloved of the Lord shall dwell in safety, and the Lord shall cover him all the day long, and he shall dwell between his shoulders." And there is the promise of safety and security and peace, the perseverance of the saints. The fifth promise to the true people of God and the Church of Christ in particular. And verse 13, "And of Joseph he said, blessed of the Lord be his land, for the precious things of heaven, for the dew and for the deep that coucheth beneath." And here the promises are of fruitfulness and of the provision of God. You can see it going all the way down to 17. What tremendous prose is this? It's poetry. "For the precious fruits," verse 14, "brought forth by the sun, and for the precious things put forth by the moon, and for the chief things of the ancient mountains, and for the precious things of the lasting hills," and so on. And so the promises go. And then I take you down to verse 18. "And of Zebulun he said, rejoice, Zebulun, in thy going out, and Issachar, in thy tents." And the promises here are for expansion through the world. The promises of Zebulun, in thy going out and in thy tents. So the church, militant and mobile, is referred to in those verses. And then verse 20, and of Gad, each tribe is blessed, but all the promises are for us. Of Gad he said, blessed be he that enlargeth Gad. He dwelleth as a lion, and teareth the arm with the crown of his head. And the great point here is defence of the truth and of believers. God will defend his true people. God will give insight and discernment to his people, or to certain of them, to warn against errors and dangers and false doctrines. And Gad represents here the defender of Israel. And we can go on down to, that's in verse 21 as well, and we can go down to verse 22. And of Dan, he said, and I think here in verse 22, I'm down to the 10th promise. Of Dan, he said, Dan is a lion's whelp, and he shall leap from Bashan. And the promise of this unusual verse is that of energy and zeal. God, by the Spirit, will give his people energy and zeal to represent him. And verse 23 of Naphtali, he said, O Naphtali, satisfied with favour and full with the blessing of the Lord, possess thou the west and the south. And the key word in the verse is satisfied, the 11th promise. The people of God who read the word and pray before their Lord will be deeply and richly and wonderfully satisfied with spiritual light and blessings. They won't need the distractions and the alluring things of this vain world. And verse 24, of Asher, he said, the 12th promise, let Asher be blessed with children, let him be acceptable to his brethren, and let him dip his foot in oil. Spiritual prosperity is particularly mentioned, and generations will follow. It is a special blessing for Christian people that so very many of their children come to the Lord. And verse 25, thy shoes shall be iron and brass, unusual in those days. And as thy days, so shall thy strength be. Well, you can see this is the promise of resilience, great resilience against all the enemies of the faith. And then I go down to verse 26. But now the residual promises are not to the tribes, but to all of Israel. There is none like unto the God of Jeshurun, the righteous one, the name of Israel, but the true Israel is referred to, who rideth upon the heaven in thy help, and in his excellency on the sky. And the sense is that the people of God ride upon the heavens through the help of God and actually enter into his excellency in the sky. Not that we become as excellent as he, but meaning that we enjoy his presence and his power almost as though we see him already. The great blessings to the church of experience of God. And help, look at verse 27. Of help, the eternal God is thy refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms, the promise of the help of the Lord. And then verse 28, safety in separation from the world. Israel then shall dwell in safety alone. We dwell in safety alone. You'll never have spiritual safety if you're compromised, if you're looking to worldly things as well as spiritual things. Israel shall dwell in safety alone. The fountain of Jacob shall be upon a land of corn, and we will be provided for. Not necessarily materially, but certainly spiritually. And then verse 29, happiness, happy art thou, O Israel, Who is like unto thee? O people, saved by the Lord, the shield of thy help, and who beside you is the sword of his excellency? And thine enemies shall be found liars unto thee, and thou shalt tread upon their high places. There's a twofold promise there, happiness and vindication. And if I've remembered them all, vindication is the 17th promise. A whole list of promises which are to us. What a passage to meditate on in your private devotions. Pick out the promises, and they're all for you, and they're all for us, the Church of Jesus Christ, the blessings of the true Zion. Well, our time is well up, but I couldn't stop in the middle of that. In the final chapter, which is very short, well, Moses is described as the greatest of the prophets. Not quite the greatest of the Old Testament prophets, because John the Baptist, so Christ tells us, was greater than him. And he was a great prophet and a great minister of God and leader of God's people, not only because of the teaching which he was given, and remember this, Moses preached positively and negatively, but he was also great because of the tremendous number of miracles he was given to work. Moses makes Elijah look like a small man. Moses, for miracles and wonders and signs, outstripped everybody until, and you know what I'm going to say, until the coming of Jesus Christ, who did far more even, and the greatest miracle of all, the atoning death for his people on Calvary's cross and the resurrection from the dead. But as far as the Old Testament is concerned, there's nobody like Moses. And he didn't die of natural causes, because the last chapter tells him he was fit as a fiddle. God took him. God took him, and God buried him. No man buried him, because nobody knew where he was buried. And God did that intentionally, so that he should not be venerated, so that he should not be worshipped, venerated, made too much of, because the teaching of Moses was to be infinitely more important than the man. And he was the meekest of all men. And so it is with us. If we're teachers, it's the teaching that matters, not the man. And we must remember that. But that's the end of the book of Deuteronomy, the capstone of the Pentateuch, the books of Moses. And if you go back to them again and again and you read Deuteronomy in your private devotions, I can guarantee this, every time you'll read it, you'll see wonderful things you never saw the previous time. It's a very deep book and a very wonderful book. May God bless it to our hearts. Let's sing as we close the hymn.